House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And at the beginning, I'm going to make an announcement. With the support of the Speaker, I'd ask Representative Reardon to put together a work group to develop new tools that help support housing affordability and choice. Representative Reardon will be joined by Representative Parrish, and they pulled together a balanced group of stakeholders. They set an aggressive timeline to develop solutions, and we'll be checking in with this committee along the way, and we look forward to hearing back from this group. So thank you. And then we're going to have a summary of committee legislative concepts. Representative Wisnett, you want to talk about LC 103?
Representative Nathanson's with me, too.
Good. I didn't see you. I'm sorry, Nancy. Welcome. Come on up.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Representative Gene Wisnett, House District 53.
And I'm Representative Nancy Wilkinson, House District 13.
Madam Chair, the Representative and I think we've had four meetings on this subject. We've had involvement by all the stakeholders, and I think we're moving the right way. Our last meeting in November, we had a white paper presented to us by the representatives of the residents, and we agreed, because of time suspense, we'd go ahead and submit that, realizing we had to make may have to make some changes, because there were still some concerns and questions from the owners. And we got the draft Monday the 10th, and also discovered some need some technical fixes. So I think we're moving the right way, but we will have to do some amendments to report back to you. If the committee has any questions on this, you remember the bill we were working on? This was the notification to the residents about sales mobile.
We're going to be able to see
in there. And with the leadership of Nancy, Representative Nathanson, and good inputs from the stakeholders, I hope we bring back good policy for you at the end.
Any questions? We're very excited to hear this bill. Thank you very much.
Nancy,
do you say something more?
I'll just reiterate what you heard about a month or so ago. This is a much simplified approach. It's a different approach than the bill that had been considered last year. It's very simplified. Both sides have agreed they're giving up something. Indeed, both sides are giving up something, and they both agree that this way will work, and they can both both live with it, that it can be implemented and work. So as Representative Wisnett said, and I really thank him for his help through all this, we handled the work group as a partnership, and we were both personally involved the whole way, and we think that we've got the new approach ready for you, except, as he mentioned, there are a few more technical fixes that need to be made to the bill. But the general approach is what both sides have agreed on.
I would thank you, and Representative, for the comments and everything. And for the committee, I just also remind you that I think we've reported to you before that both sides of this issue agreed up front that we think this is valuable housing that needs to be available to a certain group of our citizens, and we want to be sure that we maintain that availability of that housing. And also, along with that, we want to respect and try to recognize the concerns of owners and also the residents.
And I know you've been working on this for many, many months, and you've had all the stakeholders involved, and it sounds like you've gotten pretty much buy-in from both sides of this issue.
We'll hope.
Yes. And I think we have an interest in hearing this early on in February. We're hoping that it will be ready for hearings and testimony, and so that we can move on this quickly. It's an issue that needs to be dealt with before any more of these properties get sold, and make sure that people who are living in these manufactured homes can stay in their homes. Any questions or comments? Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know. I just don't know where it is.
Send it to me here a second.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, I have a lottery bill, 123, and we have, it's a committee bill. And you've heard the data before about the thousands of Oregonians with gambling addiction and the proliferation of neighborhood state-run video gaming establishments. LC 123 aims to support the Lottery Commission's efforts to promote responsible gambling and has picked up several of the lottery's own suggestions to put into statute. Specifically, this bill requires the Oregon State Lottery Commission to adopt a comprehensive responsible gaming policy with advice from stakeholders, including the lottery employees, lottery retailers, mental health professionals, and others. The policy must include a code of practice, procedures to assure that decision makers are informed about the effects lottery games and marketing have on vulnerable populations, so that they have a fuller understanding when making decisions. And the policy must include strategies to minimize the risk of harm to vulnerable individuals. In addition, the bill requires the Oregon Lottery and Health Authority to jointly report to the legislature each year about responsible and problem gambling activities. Colleagues, there's new leadership, as you know, in the lottery, and we feel confident that it's moving in the right direction. And this bill aims to support what the commission is currently doing, and by putting it in statute, continue those good policies long into the future. So we've heard lots and lots of testimony and different pieces of legislation about this issue in the past. And because of the input from the Lottery Commission and the Lottery Administration, we hope that this will be a bill that will support their ongoing efforts. Any questions?
Thank you for your work on this.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I want to talk also about LC 122. In the past year, a handful of nonprofit providers of low-income housing have received tax bills from the counties for property that has not previously been taxed. These nonprofits had always relied on tax exemptions described in statute. I can't read anymore. Can you read this for me, please?
Probably not.
I'm getting over the flu, and so, anyway.
You're right here. This next paragraph.
I think I should read that.
Okay, these nonprofits had always relied on tax exemptions described in statute that applied to property used for charitable purposes. In February of last year, the Oregon Tax Court ruled that the property tax exemption, as currently written, does not apply to property that is leased to a private individual. This is because the lessee is a recipient of the charity, not a provider of the charity. The tax court expressed sympathy for the nonprofits, but ultimately had to rule on the technical aspects of the lease agreement. This case is currently on appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. Needless to say, this decision came as quite a shock to the nonprofits who have always budgeted around this exemption. LC 122 would simply maintain the status quo of how counties interpreted the tax treatment of low-income housing properties as of July 1, 2012. This will provide relief to providers of low-income housing while avoiding unintended consequences of completely reworking this section of the law. There you go.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, colleagues, any questions or concerns about this bill? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will this be, we'll have to go through revenue with this too? Is that after we pass it?
Somebody's saying yes. Possibly. Probably. You're on the revenue committee, right? Yeah.
Seems likely.
Yeah.
I would say so.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm glad we're doing this bill. This has significantly impacted a couple of the nonprofits in my district, the Ark of Benton County, the Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. It's been an issue.
Right, and something that came up unexpectedly, nobody was prepared for. We want to support our nonprofits. I know Representative Gilliam feels that strongly.
Thrilled by this
bill. It's one of the ways that we can support them. So great. So these will be committee bills. I'm going to close the Information hearing, thank you, and open up a work session so that we can put these into committee bills. Yes. And a vote in favor of merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It's not indicative of a member's opinion or position, if any, on the content of the measure. Any questions or concerns about that? If not, I will close the informational hearing, open up a work session.
He's got it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 103, dated January 15, 2014, LC 122, dated January 9, 2014, and LC 123, dated January 13, 2014.
Representative Gomberg has moved that the legislative concepts just recited be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the concept introduces committee bills. Thank you, committee. That's terrific. We're on our way. Sorry? Close the work session. Thank you. Now, Representative Gallegos, are you wanting
could
to hold off on your member bill?
Could I wait a little bit?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
So, Representative Gilliam, I think you have a member bill, and you can just speak from the here if you want to, or you go down and speak at the desk.
No, it would make me nervous.
I know. We don't want to make you nervous.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just quickly tell you that this is our third. Basically, I offered up my bill for our third elder abuse prevention bill. As many of you know in this building, the substantive things that we've done in the first two bills sometimes get lost in when you're wrangling over what this bill focuses on, which is definitions. And it's important that we get the definitions right. It's a little frustrating when you sort of hit a bump in the road and you can't get everybody to agree. As of yesterday, the report came back from my co-chair, Representative Hoyle, that the majority of the stakeholders were now back on board. Some of the definitions have been laid aside and won't be in the bill, but I think the report was about six of the seven are agreed upon.
Good.
I can't be specific because I haven't been in this particular subcommittee of our work group. In this situation, I prefer that Representative Hoyle does the tough work.
Yeah.
And then if they pass it, I'll take the credit.
Sure.
But, you know, for me and those listening or haven't been involved in the definitions, one of the good examples of how important this is in the case of elder care, we have many times miscues on what abuse is. And the best example I got is a pretty simple one is, for instance, if a caregiver hooks up a television or a radio or some other, a fan or something for a client and leaves the cord out, that is currently reported if the client trips on it. And we all know when we're getting older, a fall in the home can be a very serious issue. That's considered abuse. And that should be probably a adverse event. So those are the kind of things that we're sorting out so that we're more clear. Certainly these things need to be reported, but they don't need to be reported as abuse. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things are the things they're hammering out. I think we're going to have a bill that we can support more soon, as how I would end this little report. We are meeting, the full work group is meeting today in the middle of the day. We'll have a more complete report. But I believe we'll have something to bring to the committee that we can be proud of.
Great. Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah.
Good job. Thank you, Representative. Representative Gilzer, I think you have a bill coming to our committee.
I do. Thank you. And I think Chris just brought some hard copies of this bill. It's LC 198, and this is a bill relating to youth suicide. I've been learning a lot about youth suicide since we introduced some legislation last session. Representative Olson was a co-sponsor of this bill to make it easier to do depression screenings for youth in public schools. And the issue that came up after that is what happens to kids after we've identified that they are at risk. It turns out that we have a very high suicide rate in the state of Oregon. Across all ages, our suicide rate is 41% higher than the national average. 41% higher than the national average. I was surprised to learn that in 2006, over 1,400 youth aged 10 to 17 were treated in Oregon hospital emergency rooms for suicide attempts. Over 1,400 kids.
Oh, in 1 year?
In 1 year. That was in 2006. In 2009, 16% of Oregon high school junior girls and 10.8% of Oregon high school junior boys reported that they had seriously considered suicide within the last 12 months. In my own community, we lost three young people between the middle of October and the week before Christmas to suicide, and that didn't count the attempts. We also know that we know oftentimes who these kids are. Usually it's not their first attempt when they complete suicide. And generally, especially girls, have told somebody that that is what their plan is. We do have an Oregon Youth Suicide Prevention Plan, but it hasn't been updated since the late 1990s. And a lot has changed since that time. It's probably worth looking at that again. It's also worth having a more open conversation about the problem of youth suicide and what resources are available to kids and families and schools when things come up. And I just wanted to share this little piece that I got from someone. Their name isn't attached. This woman says, "Our daughter has struggled with mental health issues and depression since she was very small. She's had two acute hospitalizations and is currently in a residential mental health center in another part of the state. She's talked about wanting to die since she was 8 and has attempted to kill herself. Trying to get help for her has been so heartbreaking. In the fall, we were desperate for help. We took her to the ER, where they threatened to restrain her to the bed. When the county crisis worker got there, 2 hours after us, she had screamed herself to sleep. The worker looked at us and her and said, 'Things seem to have calmed down.' He gave us a number and sent us home. There were many hurdles before getting her a bed. It took weeks. Our other children had to stay with parents. My husband had to quit his job, and we stayed with her every minute, 24 hours a day. She got increasingly suicidal and violent. I was floored at the lack of help. The crisis workers were telling us this is a process. Take her to the ER if needed. Call the police. It takes time. On one of our worst days, I had my phone right next to me waiting to hear from the county. This was the same day a young person in the region tragically killed herself. The worker called us right before 5 and told us she's sorry she didn't get back to us, but there had been a suicide in the community, and this was a crisis. All I could feel was fear for my own child and anger that someone successfully killing themselves is what was finally a crisis." And then she goes on to say that she would like to help bring awareness and protect the privacy of her child in the process. So the bill that we have looks at a position that we already have, the Suicide Prevention Coordinator, changes the name to the Suicide Prevention and Intervention Coordinator. So we can look at, once we've identified these things, how do we... what are we doing to intervene? It asks that a report come to the legislature each year about the patterns of suicide in the state. Where are these things happening? How many high schools are impacted? What are the barriers to kids getting help? And it does move the Suicide Prevention and Intervention Coordinator. Right now it's in the public health program, which is more focused on upstream prevention. It moves it into addictions and mental health because both of those pieces are very important. But right now, if we're training people to identify when kids are in trouble and we can offer them nothing when they get there, that's a problem. Ideally, I've talked to Representative Buckley, it would be great to have a person in both mental health and addictions and mental health, and I hope that's a conversation that we can have. But this is an important bill, and I hope we can hear it early in February.
Great, let's do that. Great, thank you, Representative. Any questions? Comments?
Thank you. Thank you for working on this. I have a constituent who's tragically lost his only child at age 21 and has gone through just the similar kinds of issues, and I know he's really eager to work on this. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Gelso, I appreciate you moving forward with this too as well, because we do need to address kind of an updating type method toward it. I mean, from my experience I've found over the years that it seems to be that it's contagious amongst youth. Once you get, and that's why it becomes so important to have something as a procedure in place, some access to be able to get ahead of the game. And that's why you also see why you have the response team show as quickly as they do to try to capture that and slow that all down. So appreciate you doing this.
Thanks. Okay, thank you very much, Representative. Representative Kenham, are you here?
Yeah, Barnhart.
Pardon? Barnhart? Okay, Representative Barnhart, go ahead. Come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the State Representative from House District 11, Central Lane and Linn Counties. Today I bring you LC Draft 213, which is on the topic of e-cigarettes. This committee is very well aware of the hazards and expenses involved in the use of nicotine. And, of course, you've worked for many years in the area of addiction prevention and regulation of cigarettes and other tobacco products. Nicotine products that are addicting are responsible for a major portion of our health care costs in Oregon. Of course, secondhand smoking is an extremely dangerous thing for those who are not themselves smokers. The purpose of this bill is to update our law because of the new products that are coming out that are generically known as e-cigarettes. These are products that really are in two parts. There's a device, a paraphernalia that is designed to vaporize and allow for the inhalation of a vapor product. And then there's the product itself, which may contain nicotine, it may contain flavorings, it may contain scentings and such. Our current law, according to LC, does not apply to e-cigarettes. So we have this very elaborately, carefully worked out law in place around the use of tobacco by minors. We don't allow it. Around where it is it's not legal to smoke. But none of those laws apply to e-cigarettes. What prompted me to bring this bill was my experience when I was sitting in the airport waiting room in Eugene, waiting to get on a plane, and the man sitting next to me had this strange-looking vapor coming out of his mouth, and it wasn't smoke because it moved in a straight line. It didn't look like smoke. It dawned on me. His hand kind of covering something, and it dawned on me after a while that this was an e-cigarette. I'd never seen one before. I had no idea what it was. I have to tell you that I deeply resented being in the same room where a man was using this product and putting nicotine or something else, probably nicotine, into the air for the rest of us sitting in the waiting room to breathe. So I brought this bill. This bill has two pieces to it, essentially. And let me say first that the bill breaks no new ground, zero. It simply applies the law that we currently have to tobacco products to these new devices. And it applies the rule that we already have in place that prevents minors from being able to legally purchase and others to sell to them tobacco products that would now apply to e-cigarettes. That's very similar to, although I think our definitions are slightly different, to the bill that Representative Olson has brought. The other component of the bill is one that applies the exact same restrictions to the use of e-cigarettes that we have for smoking. So that no smoking places where smoking is not allowed, the use of e-cigarettes will also not be allowed if this bill is adopted as written. The bill is fairly long, and simply a quick comment about that. Our tobacco laws have grown slowly by accretion over the years. They're not all in one place. They're scattered out through the statute. I think Mark Mayer in the Legislative Council Office has done a pretty good job of finding the various places where the statute needs to be changed. Most of the time as you look through this bill, you'll find that the change is one word or a few words. The key component of this bill is the definition of vaping and the like. And if you have specific questions about that, I would refer you to him. He and I worked very hard on that definition, and we think we have it right. But I would commend this bill to your to you. It does have an emergency clause, and the reason for that is that this particular use of nicotine products is growing very rapidly, and every day, kids who can legally buy these products now are becoming addicted to nicotine. People on this committee know that if people don't experiment with nicotine products until after they're 20 or 21 or 22, the odds of them becoming addicted are very, very low. Tobacco companies need, they won't tell you this, but they need to have eighth graders starting to smoke or use e-cigarettes or whatever in order to maintain an addiction rate that will allow them to make a profit. Now, that's a nasty, awful thing to say, but it's the only way their business model in the long term works. Our job, it seems to me, is to keep up with the arms race between the various ways that nicotine can be applied to the human body, and make sure that our rules apply to that, to those in a reasonable way. There are other things that ought to be done to our tobacco laws. This bill does not cover those other things because it's a bill that I'd like to see passed in this short session. And so the only decision the committee needs to make is, do we want to apply the current law we have around tobacco to e-cigarettes? Do we want to restrict minors from using them? And do we want to restrict the use of them in places where it's already not lawful to smoke? That's it.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this, because you know I'm passionate about this issue too. Are you bringing it to this committee because of the housing part of this committee and your building restriction? Because I'm curious about why not health.
Around this issue?
If I could, Madam Chair, I think the reason that I wanted it to come to this committee is because it is basically related to human services. And the general health of the community is related to either the cessation or the non-use of a very dangerous addicting substance. And we looked at possibly sending it to the Judiciary Committee, but we're not changing any of the specific rules. We're just applying this new product to the rules we already have. Thought about the Health Committee, and by that time, the Speaker had already told us that it was coming here.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I'd like to relate a similar experience. Last week, my husband and I were driving up and stopped at a Subway sandwich store, and a 12-year-old boy had one of these e-cigarettes, and he was in the line to purchase a sandwich, and he was blowing the vapor back over the food, and the people in the store had no idea, you know, because it's not against the law to do that. And I was wondering, is there nicotine that comes back out in the vapor?
That's my understanding. Okay. I will be producing a one-pager. There is an article in the from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration about health warnings, and I believe that one of the things that's in there is that the vapor contains whatever it is that's in the capsule. Now, some of these capsules don't contain nicotine. Some of them contain other substances which are maybe even more noxious. They all contain something called diethylene glycol, which may be carcinogenic and is one of the main ingredients used in antifreeze. So, because these things are growing so rapidly, it makes sense to me as a public health issue to apply the restrictions we already have on tobacco, other tobacco tobacco products, and applying it. The definition has been written very carefully, so it does not apply to my grandson's humidifier, for example. We tried to make sure we only covered these kinds of products.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Whitson, to your question, I've gone out and I've visited with a number of retailers regarding this whole thing, and also had the opportunity to see exactly what it is. And it's pretty fascinating because they have five main products of the simulators, and they'll range anywhere from $35 up to $150, and they're battery operated, and they do produce a vapor. The liquid that you can buy, the product that you can buy, can be non-nicotine or nicotine, so you don't know what you get. President Barnhart's right. I mean, this is taken off like a rocket, like you can't believe, and I do think we have to do something with it.
I seldom watch the Academy Awards or the Golden Globes, but I really love Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. So I was watching it, and what is the name? The woman who had been on Seinfeld. Yes, was smoking one of these, and the camera went right to her smoking this and blowing the vapor out. I thought, oh my God, that's just what we need. So I'm glad both of you are following up on this. Thank you very much. Any other questions of Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Thank you for bringing it for our committee. Is there anybody here speaking for Representative Kennemer? Maybe I will wait for, let's see, what else do we have going on? It's going to be hard to. Pardon?
We can go.
Are you ready? Okay, let's go.
I'm ready.
President Gallegos, go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's I think, I was going to say refreshing, but I don't think that's the right word. Encouraging, I think, this morning to hear the various bills being brought forth. I mean, I was thinking about suicide or elder abuse and even e-cigarettes, and we're really talking about prevention this morning, and I think that's really great. The bill that we've been working on is coming. It's special to me, I think, as a gerontologist and as a mental health specialist. Spending years doing research on aging and the aging process. Hopefully all of us will continue to age for a long time, and happily so. But unfortunately, that's not happening for everybody, healthy, happy aging. And so my bill really has to do with protecting seniors. So most of you are familiar with CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. That was set in place by the legislature 30 years ago, and literally thousands of children have benefited from that program of volunteers appointed by a judge to assist minors navigate through the court systems. Elder abuse protections are dramatically behind child welfare protection in our state, and today we are seeing more and more of our aging population qualify as protected persons. Protected persons are adults as well, people who are over the age of 18 who have cognitive impairments that enable them from being able to be their best own advocates. So what we're after then is in cases judges in our system have the ability to appoint protected persons or a guardian who assumes responsibility for managing the legal, financial decisions of the protected person. So increasingly, I think, you know, we're all aware that the aging population is increasing. I don't know if you're aware, but within the next couple of years, at least 25% of the population will be over 65 years of age. So as the numbers increase, then these incidents of abuse will increase as well. And even with our guardians, in 2011, there were 36 guardians or conservators of protected people who were reported perpetrators. So the goal of the bill that we're proposing, LC 105, is to give courts and judges the authority to appoint a special advocate for protected persons or persons who have a legal guardian judiciary. So basically that's what it's about. And I want to read a letter that Mary Yeager provided to us. And Mary is the director of the State Ombudsman Program, a very successful volunteer program. This letter is to urge your support of LC 105, which creates the protected person special advocate language within the Oregon guardianship statute. With no fiscal to the state, the bill slightly edits the existing Oregon guardianship statute. The edit will allow a probate court judge to appoint a trained volunteer to peek in, if you will, on an existing guardianship and report back to the court if there are issues for the court to consider and to follow up on. Currently, the guardian only needs to report to the court annually about a protected person. This bill will allow county judges to appoint volunteers to serve as eyes and ears of the court and to offer protection from potential elder abuse by going to the community and checking on the protected person to see how things are going. If indeed the court can, then ask for more information. The amazing part of this work is that it's done by volunteers in the community who report directly back to the judge. We often say that elder abuse protections are 30 years behind child welfare in Oregon. Again, 30 years ago, we had the CASA statute. Since then, literally thousands of children have benefited from that statute, and this bill will pave the way for a county judge to appoint a similar type of volunteer for seniors. So that's the bill, and we really hope we can count on everybody's support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gillies.
It's not a question, if that's okay. I just want to add my support of this bill. I talked to Joe about this yesterday, and I'm very excited about it for a number of reasons that he mentioned. On my way in today, something was wrong with my radio, and I thought I had OPB blocked, but I was listening to it, and it pointed out that despite the Portlandia sort of image of Portland, Oregon is actually older by median age than the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
We have got to do more, as you've heard me say before, to be prepared to protect our most vulnerable aging population. Representative Gelser was talking about her bill, which I also am supportive of, and it's about intervention. If we're checking in once a year on a client who needs this kind of care, we're not plugged in. One of my big problems with our committee and the work we do, of course, is every time we want to do something, we add FTEs. And it's needed, but that's where the budget gets broken. This is volunteer-based. And when he mentioned the name Mary Yeager to me yesterday, I was on board because of her long-term care ombudsman. We've all heard her here testifying. She knows how to recruit quality people. She knows how to train them. And that's how that program works all across our state, is through volunteers. And this one, as Joe pointed out, will as well. This is a good bill, and it's something we can move forward with without a fiscal and actually have an impact on protecting seniors.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions, sir?
I'd love to add my support for all those reasons, and I believe Mary Yeager used to run CASA for Children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that we have someone that knows that program inside out and has been the ombudsman for elder abuse kinds of issues. So it's a fabulous bill.
It is a fabulous bill, but I hope you realize this does not fix everything. Mary has testified in here. Over 60 to 70% of the people in extended care never, ever, ever get a visitor.
Yeah, right.
They have nobody else looking in. So, and there are some counties, representatives, that don't have any CASA or any, what is the program she runs?
Ombudsman
in their county. So we need to encourage those counties to advocate for these folks. So thank you very much. I look forward to hearing this bill. And I see that Representative Kennemer has come in. There he is. Terrific.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Thank you for some time, and nice to see you here, Madam Chair, and see you slightly healthier. I wish you were a little more. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about a bill draft regarding some lottery concerns. I think a lot of us in the legislature have had concern for the some estimated 70,000 Oregonians that are addicted to Oregon lottery. and it's a rather alarming number, and it's a big concern. Some of us have been meeting informally, Representative Tomei and Representative Kenny-Geyer and Representative Parrish and I have been meeting informally and have been working on these issues for a number of years. As you'll recall, this last legislative session, the former director of the lottery solicited an attorney general's opinion that suggested that the spending of money on the prevention of gambling was not commensurate with the public good. And it was kind of an interesting, out of their administrative funds, I should add. And that was kind of a shocker to most of us. And in response to that, we thought we would create a bill that simply maintained the status quo in terms of financing. We're not increasing the amount of money spent on prevention or on treatment, but let's maintain it and let's set that standard as the new minimum. And so this bill has simply two provisions that are new. One is the net proceeds from the Oregon State Lottery allocated to funds under ORS 461.549, the Oregon Health Authority, shall expend 16.67% of the monies to promote or advertise the availability of programs for prevention and treatment of gambling addiction and other emotional and behavioral problems related to gambling. So that addresses the issue of maintaining it at the current level. The second issue is that commensurate with public good has been interpreted principally by the Lottery Commission as maximizing revenue. And I think that's arguably potentially a halfway reasonable thing. On the other hand, 70,000 addictions are not commensurate with public good, and I think that's a policy that most of us in the legislature could agree with. So the second addition that I think is significant in this bill is the language, the addiction of an extensive number of individuals to lottery games is not commensurate with the public good. And that way we establish a legislative finding regarding this so that we find some balance and we get back to the balance that I think common sense and good policy dictate. So with that, I look forward to bringing the bill forward, and I appreciate this opportunity to update you on our work, and I hope we can get this passed. And thank you. And thanks. Perhaps there are questions or comments.
Thanks for your work on this, Representative. Any questions or statements?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, Representative Kinnamer, what are the odds, you think, of this bill passing?
I'm liking to think it's in the 90%.
How's that?
This is almost a sure bet, if you'll pardon the pun. Yes, thank you for that opportunity. And incidentally, there are opportunities to co-sponsor, and preferably today, and I'll be particularly looking for you two, but anybody else, if you have an interest, please let me know, and we will drop by and get your signature.
Terrific.
Because I'll not be in the building tomorrow, but need to get it done today. So thank you so much.
Any other questions or comments?
No.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Kennedy.
Okay.
Now we're moving on to the early learning system update with Jada Ruffley. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. Thank you for having us back. And it's I just want to say thank you, because as I listen to many of the weighty issues that you're dealing with, you've started us well on a pathway at the very beginning, but you still have so much work to do in all of the areas. And as a future aging adult, I want to make sure things are good for me as we go forth. My name is Dottie Ruplay. I'm the Early Learning System Director of your new Early Learning Division at the Department of Education. And with me today, we have Megan Irwin, and she is working on the transformation of the Early Learning Hubs. What I'd like to do, because I've seen your agenda and it's very, very busy and I know time is short, is what we would like to do is just talk to you a little bit about the hub process and where we are in that. And then I've provided for you a full update on the other programs. And if there are any questions from members, we'd like to do that. And then I've also provided a, that went out yesterday and today, a letter of community interest for round two of hubs. So we're already trying to get ahead of the curve as we're looking at that. So in round one, as you know, that we did move forward with one application without reservation and five more that we have been in the process of negotiation with communities to make sure that they are able to move forward with readiness. We spent time in some initial staff negotiations with them in Salem, and then as late as 10 o'clock last night, Megan and her team returned from Burns, where they spent time in the community to see the Frontier Hub application to do that. So we are in the process now of going out to those communities after we had those initial discussions. As they finalize some of their strategic plans and answering requests, I think this is the place that we all wanted to get to. We're out of the competitive application where there's radio silence, and we're working together with those communities and helping them not only begin to learn from each other, but providing the technical assistance they need to be successful. We will do the final determination at the Early Learning Council on February 13th. So at that point, all of the proposals will be presented to the council for final approval to go ahead and get started. And as you see by our letter, we've already started in round two to make sure that we are looking at how we do that. We set the bar very high, and much of what that happened was in the conversations that we had not only with you as a committee, but individual members and communities. And the readiness bar and some of the changes, they felt very strongly at the Early Learning Council, as well as us as staff, to move slowly, and that's how we feel we've done. At the same time, we know we can't just leave the rest of the communities out there to sink or swim, and so we've set in place the motion of support, and I'm going to let Megan talk to you a little bit about round two.
Thanks, Jonna. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Irwin, Early Learning System Design Manager for the Early Learning Division. And what that means is I'm staff to the launch and implementation of the Early Learning Hubs. And I am here today to give just a brief process update on what we're doing to support the second round application process. So in the first batch of hub applications, we saw that communities, for the most part, really struggled with putting forth a plan of action that met the statutory requirements for cross-sector, cross-geography work, and presented a really cohesive and focused plan aligned to the outcomes that the council is asking for to deliver results. And so we want to recognize the tremendous work that communities have done to get over the first hurdle of figuring out who to partner with and who to work with across sectors and across geographies, which we think are two pretty big, hard things to figure out when you're trying to come together to do this work. And we think that communities across the state still need a lot of help in figuring out how to build a plan that's going to drive different behaviors and different approaches to early learning service delivery. And so last week, we actually rolled out a support team that's available to all prospective applicants, and we've had quite a few requests already to guide our prospective hub communities through the challenges of planning a new service delivery model, aligning the actions that they want to do to the outcomes that the council is asking for, with kindergarten readiness as the real North Star for this work, and coming up with ways to govern themselves in this new model. And then for the few communities across the state that are still struggling with who to partner with and what geography do they want to put together for themselves, we're also making some conflict mediation support available. All of that support is being delivered through the Oregon Solutions Network. The second round application will go live in late March, early April, like that first week of April, last week of March. And we expect the next round of early learning hubs to be identified in June, and then to spend July and August finalizing contracts with them, probably much in the way that we're doing right now. We'll probably have a wave that is ready to go without reservation, and then a wave where we'll need to do a similar contract negotiation support process to what we're doing now with the five hubs we're currently working with.
That concludes our report, and we're available for any questions that any of the members may have.
Any questions?
Colleagues.
Representative Witt, did I see a hand up?
Okay.
Yes. I noticed you have a field test conducted in four regions across Oregon. Could you tell us what the results of that were, of those, and what sorts of problems you encountered? I mean, since the field test was conducted, what did you find out?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, she is speaking on our update. We're basically talking about the quality rating improvement system, and actually that has gone statewide. And we actually, at the November meeting, rolled out some of our quality providers. And one of the things that is the hope for Oregon as we move forward is that you will see providers participating on a voluntary basis. And so when I, as a parent, would look at choosing childcare, I would know that a five-star provider was the very top-rated provider in the state. And three, four, and five have also gone through a significant amount of education and training and coaching to work with children in their homes.
So, yeah. So when you say field test, could you explain what the results of the test were in terms of what the outcomes as you expected them and what they actually were?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I believe that what the field test was to look at the model that we had put together to make sure that the model of being able to do that, and I actually could give you a card. We were looking at doing this next month with, as you came back, in terms of the Early Learning Council members, but I can share with you what a five-star, four-star, and three-star found in the field study, and I'll actually just make an appointment and talk with you further about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to meet later today, and so I'll have a lot more detailed questions, but is any member of the ELC board here today? There's no one here.
They are not here today.
I think I've expressed to you, Director, individually that I don't consider this a success. I don't know if you, the staff does, or the board, but I don't consider it a success. Well, a year ago, we authorized you up to six or seven hubs, and you have one. There's a lot of staff and time and a lot of reports, paperwork, but this is all about serving children and communities and families, and I don't consider that a success.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Well, I know you've done a lot of incredible work, and you have a long way to go, so I recognize that, but I do want to applaud you for the work that you've done. I have a couple questions around the hubs. I'd love to have questions on all of them, but just focusing on the hubs right now. So the I'm assuming that the five, you were going to put a certain amount of money toward hubs, and then I think it was $30,000 per county to just continue contracting with services if they weren't hubs. And so I'm assuming that the five are getting some kind of ongoing support in this transition period, or if they weren't approved, they would fall into that category of getting some kind of funding to continue services. Is that right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenninger, and to a certain degree Representative Wisnett, is that we did not stop any of the flow of the service delivery money to the counties. They continue to provide all those services to children, and I believe that has something. And so regardless of the hub setup, this is more for the infrastructure and the setup of those new six that we have talked about. One plan is ready to go, and the other five, we have not released any of the infrastructure dollars, but the programs have continued in the health of families and the home visiting and the many programs that have been in existence. So there has been no change in that, and that's not geared to go into change until July 1 of 2014.
Okay. Is a follow-up on the hub? And as I understand it, the contracts for the hubs will be on an annual basis, at least to begin. And I know you've been having conversations about what successful look like at the end of year one. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at right now?
Absolutely. I'm going to let Megan go ahead and talk about some of the outcomes and measurements that we've got.
Sure. Representative Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, the Early Learning Council has set a set of metrics related to kindergarten readiness and family stability that we'll be looking to see progress on in the first contract year, which will go through June 30th, 2015. And we will be working with our hubs to, once we get through this final phase of contracting, to define a series of process metrics to understand what success looks like in the first year of getting infrastructure and service coordination up and going, where we know that we will want to see some progress on kindergarten readiness and the additional metrics that the council is asking for. But in the first year of a launch, you're also really looking at how are people coming together to do this work and what are the indicators that systems and sectors are actually coordinating and changing behavior. And we want to do that work with the hubs instead of handing them a mandate of what coordination should look like in their community.
Can I follow up one more?
Follow up.
So data is related to all that, and I know you've been talking about how do you give them technical assistance to build their data systems, how do you build your own, how do you make sure that theirs relate to each other's and to yours. Can you talk a little bit about an update on that?
Sure. Representative Tomei, Representative Kinney Geyer, members of the committee, coordinated data systems in our state are a huge challenge, which I think probably everybody sitting here and sitting in the room is aware of. So this is something that the division staff are actively working on with the Early Learning Council subcommittee that's looking to address the data systems in our state. What we're looking to do right now in the very beginning work for the hub is just find a way to aggregate data at the accountability metric level across the various agencies that own that data within the state. We're not looking to build a big, elaborate, expensive data system at the moment because there are so many additional conversations that need to happen about what that looks like across health, early learning, and into K-12 that go beyond the scope of the Early Learning Hub project. But we acknowledge that it's a real tension point and something we have a lot of work to do on as a state.
I want to acknowledge that Representative Mitch Greenlick has joined us today. I appreciate you coming, Representative. And I was able to watch and listen to your Health Committee meeting yesterday, and one of the speakers was so impressive about kindergarten readiness. It's the first 1,000 days, which includes prenatal and even pre-prenatal. So it was fascinating, and I hope to have that presenter coming to our committee also. Mm-hmm. That was terrific. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we will be having, colleagues, I know there are lots of questions and concerns. We will be having a much more intense meeting with you further in February. And would you let committee staff know when you would be prepared to do that? We'd like to have it as early as possible, but we want you to be fully prepared.
Chair Tomei, thank you very much. And we will also let you know that on February 13th, the Early Learning Council will be meeting and they will be doing visits to the various members. So
great.
You will see the council members out too.
Good.
Thank you
very much. And nice to meet you. Glad you're here. Thank you so much. Next, we will have Iris Bell, Executive Director of Youth Development Council. Iris, I hope that you got the message that we just are expecting a short presentation today, and I saw your
quickly.
Are you going to be doing this?
Well, we're going to take you through it.
Okay,
we'll get as far as we possibly can. You can, you know, tell us when.
Okay.
I thought it was important that you kind of get a sense of where we are.
Okay.
So good morning, Representative Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. So what we're here today to do is to give you an update on where we are with our process with respect to House Bill 3231 and the directions that we were given about the development of a funding allocation plan. So you did receive the entire document, I do believe, and you also probably also received a copy of our community engagement process. So these two things I think you received electronically already. So what we're going to do and what the PowerPoint actually does is kind of take you through that rather quickly. It'll actually address both of these documents in a shorter version. I don't know how much shorter that might be, but let's start, and then I'll try to go as quickly as I can. So with the executive summary, basically what we're saying here is that, you know, the legislation 3231 established the Youth Development Council as part of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and that we were charged with developing a funding plan for all of our funding streams that was due no later than January 1st, 2014. So yesterday we presented that particular plan to the Subcommittee on Education, Ways and Means of Community Education, and they accepted the report that we gave to them. What we looked at in terms of how this particular, I'm going to sort of move quick, how this particular plan kind of rolls out is we asked some questions, you know, how should we best support the work of the Oregon Education Investment Board? How should we align our efforts in this state with that of the national efforts that are going on with respect to young people? And then, you know, how should we, based on the engagements that we've had with the community, how should we begin to take a look at funding and outcomes for high needs youth? So to answer these questions, we did do this, you know, community engagement process where we went all over the state. We went over to Eastern Oregon, over to Malheur County, over to Baker County, up to LeGrand, down over to Pendleton, back over to Deschutes, up over to the Dalles area, down to Jackson County, Josephine County, out to the coast, over to Sillette. So we really did get around the state. We also wanted to take a look at how we could use data and research with respect to current policy and trend indicators around young folks. And then we wanted to take a look at the various approaches we could take as we move forward with a funding plan. So what we did in terms of our recommendations was to say that in terms of a population focus, we should be looking at opportunity and priority youth. And I'm going to give you a quick definition. I think we can sort of skip over the rest. Opportunity youth are those youth between the ages of 16 to 24 who are neither in school or working. In many instances, they're called idle youth. There are about 6.7 million of these young people in our country today. They have about a $7.3 trillion impact on our economy. In the state of Oregon, we know as we drill down, about one in seven youth are opportunity youth in our state. And what we're going to try and do is really, like I said, really focus down on those particular youth and figure out more about what their needs are and what we need to do to help them get back on track towards a trajectory of either education, career, employment. We really do need to embrace these young folks and help support them in terms of their efforts. Priority youth are those youth between the ages of 6 and 16 who are still in school, primarily a middle school age group. And what we need to do is to look at how we maintain them in school. They are at risk of leaving school. They're at risk of not making the transition from middle school to high school. In several instances, when we were out and about around the community, the middle school was right down the street from the high school, and there were percentages of those young folks who actually were not making it from the middle school to the high school. So how do we hold on to those young people? How do we have the kinds of mentoring programs, the kinds of before and after school programs that we need in community to help support these young people in getting them to move through our systems? So those are the two groups of young folks that we are really trying to focus in on in terms of our funding plan. Our foundational principles around this have to do with the fact that a community is self-determined and a community will determine and identify for us how they want to invest in these young people in their communities. They know them, they understand who they are, and how they seek to invest in them is something that we would like to engage in a conversation with them about. We're also looking at the fact that we're going to target those most in need. So we have a set of indicators of need. I think it's on a couple of pages here, and you will see that. And again, this whole notion of economic and social advancement is the long-term goal here for these young people. And this whole notion of progress being essential, we're talking about how we move the dial with these young people. We need to see some measurable outcomes with respect to what we do and how we make these investments in our community. As a result of that, we have come up with a funding plan that has four elements to it. You see them down at the bottom of page 13. We have a youth and community grant. We have a youth and gangs grant. We'll have a youth and innovations grant, and we will have a youth and crime prevention grant. And you will see the funding streams in terms of federal and state funds associated with those particular grant streams. At this point, I do want to get to, so we can go through the grant streams. I can do that quickly. I'll ask Matt to do that, because what I really want to make sure we hit today is at least the indicators of need, and I'd also like to talk a little bit more about our logic model. So, Matt, why don't you take them quickly through these grant streams, and then we can talk about the indicators of need and the logic model associated with the plan itself.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matthew Schaubold, and I'm a policy analyst with the Youth Development Council. I'm going to briefly take you through the four grant streams. I know you're short on time. If you'll start on page 14, which is the Youth and Community Grant, all four grant streams are needs-based grant streams that are utilizing a set of data indicators of need. The Youth and Community Grant, it would be a $12 million biennial grant, a tiered approach based on need with a cap and floor to ensure that there is at least $70,000 per county and tribe for programs and services for high-needs youth. Moving quickly to the Youth and Gangs Grant Fund, this would be a $750,000 biennial grant fund that, again, would be needs-based based on a demonstration of a gang problem in a community utilizing the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Comprehensive Gang Model. The Youth and Innovation Grant Fund, throughout the community engagement process, there were a number of communities that asked us to make available to them a grant fund that would allow them to utilize innovative approaches in the community, to implement innovative programs, to scale programs to operational sustainability. So the Youth Development Council created a $1.6 million Youth and Innovation Grant Fund for non-recurrent sustainable initiatives in communities. And the fourth is a Youth and Crime Prevention Grant Fund, and this is primarily made up of federal dollars, much of which is earmarked for certain communities around the state by the federal government, with an ability to issue a few small grants based on need and the goals of crime prevention in the state of Oregon. I want to take a minute here to talk about the indicators of need. The council developed the indicators of need based on a review of the research around high needs and high risk youth and why they disconnect from school, why they get involved with youth crime and violence, and why they fail to successfully transition to the labor force. The council then reconciled that research with what data was currently available at the community level and currently available for communities to utilize to target high needs areas within their county or tribe. And this was done intentionally because one of the pieces that the council members and staff heard throughout the community engagement process was that we may not have the ability or the staffing capacity to collect a whole set of new pieces of data, indicators of data. Could you utilize the data that exists right now? And for all of these indicators, while there is room for improvement, and the council intends to work on improving the data across the state, these are pieces that are being collected at a school district, census tract, county, city level, so that the folks that are accessing the resources for programs and services don't have to collect the data, but merely sit at the table with those who do and work together as a community. In addition, it was very clear in House Bill 3231, as well as within the framework of the Oregon Education Investment Board Strategic Plan, that outcomes were an essential part of whatever structure the Youth Development Council put in place for funding programs and services. The council wanted to be, again, receptive to the community, and what the council members and staff heard throughout the process was that there was a need for the ability to track community-level indicators or individual-level indicators. And so the council developed a set of outcome expectations specifically focused on individual-level tracking data or community-level tracking data, all linked to education, career, and reduced youth violence and crime. And then finally, the council created a logic model to better explain through the process how communities could come together through a collective impact approach, with which Iris is going to discuss in a second a little more detail, to apply for the funding so that there would be no unilateral applications for funding from singular organizations, but rather communities would have to come together collectively around a single issue with respect to high-needs youth, come up with a comprehensive set of activities, a shared measurement, and then apply for funds, and the council would fund those programs and services that were working with these high-needs youth.
So one of the things that we recognize, in fact, as we went around the state, several areas, several regions of the state are actually already using this whole collective impact model. And really what we're saying is that, again, a community that self-determines and self-identifies what the needs of that community are would come together. That would mean you'd be talking about your school district, your parents, your teachers, your county government, your juvenile departments, your the array of folks that make up a community would actually come together, identify what the particular concerns or needs of that community are around opportunity and priority use. They would set a common agenda about how they would go about responding to those particular needs, and then they would start to look at a set of collective activities around these young people. In addition to set of collective activities, they would also, of course, have a set of measurable shared outcomes in terms of what they would be looking to achieve. This is what this particular process, as Matt said, would ensure that communities are at the table talking about these young people. What are they going to do? How are they going to address the needs of opportunity youth? How are they going to address the needs of priority youth in their communities? And so this has everyone sitting at the table collectively doing just that, and applying then as groups of folks in communities around the particular needs that they have identified. So this is the plan. We're going to make sure that you all had a copy of this as well as the total documents themselves, and we can open it up for questions if you'd like.
So I skipped ahead, and on page 21 I was looking at the time frame.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there will be requests for applications, mm-hmm. there will be trainings, and then application review, then people will
That's
know
right.
how to apply for a grant. Then the application review, that ends May 15th, the award announcements on May 16th, and then the award, let's see, appeal, then there will be an appeal period. So by June, mm-hmm. there will be awards, right?
Exactly.
Going out to the mm-hmm. community. So that's terrific. Great. And so, Iris, thank you for going quickly through this. We appreciate that. And we will be inviting you back to get into more detail, because I know that, well, Representative Wisnett is gone, but I know this is a particular interest to him. And I think those yes. of us who have these programs in our communities that will be applying for grants will want to hear more about that, even though you will just be in the early part of the process.
Right.
So any questions or comments? Yes, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, and please give me quick answers rather than First of all, on page 18, the indicators of need, mm-hmm. are these ranked in priority order, or are these all equally weighted?
Representative Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, no, we haven't. They're not ranked in any particular order. Again, a community will look at those particular indicators, identify, you know, what necessarily are the indicators in their community, and then come together collectively to respond to those based on what they see as the most important needs.
Yes, Madam Chair, and again, a quick answer if you could. Could you give me a sense of the geographic ramifications of the proposed funding plan? How would the results of this and anticipated compare to the funding distribution that we currently have statewide?
Representative Tomei, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, we believe that this particular plan actually puts more resources in the community around the region than is currently. In fact, even our minimum grant, which is the $70,000 grant, is higher than the minimum grant that exists now. And so what we looked at was the fact that in many cases, this really does put more resource totally around the entire community for communities regionally and tribes. So both tribes, in fact, tribes will finally have access to more than just the one funding stream that they had in the old system. So this really does make for a more equitable distribution across the state, particularly for tribes and small counties.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, and that may be why Multnomah County's kind of concerned.
Oh, yeah.
But can you explain the juvenile dollars and, you know, there's been some concern.
Right now, Chair, this is not a small, short answer, but Chair Tomei and Representative Gomberg, members of the committee. Multnomah County, in fact, I've met with each of the county commissioners in Multnomah County and explained that, again, the opportunity for the community to have resources spread more broadly in the community is what would happen. Doesn't necessarily say they'd have less funding in the community. There's still the opportunity for Multnomah County to have those funds. What it requires is that Multnomah County come together with the community, that they sit down together, that the department sit down, that you have, again, the school districts at the table, that you have parents engaged in the process. So what we have said over and over again is that just bring your community to the table and sit with them. If you're getting good outcomes, why wouldn't you want those outcomes in your community, with your community, as you begin to present your application and your model? Any good outcomes is what we're looking for. And we do know that there are departments and agencies in, at county government level that are getting those good outcomes. And so our request is that you engage in the collective impact model and that you bring your folks to the table with a strengthened application. We believe that the services that are currently getting those outcomes would continue to be funded and to continue to get those particular outcomes.
Representative Whitsitt.
I think you answered part of the question, but your outreach primarily will be through the schools and the county commissions?
No. What we have been able to do, excuse me, Representative Tomei, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, Representative Wisnett, what we've been able to do as we've gone around the state is to actually engage other nonprofit providers, engage parents. We have collected and now have a greater, much more comprehensive listserv than we've ever had before. So when we get ready to announce that this is, these applications are available, we will do a extensive outreach that will be far more extensive than what we've had in the past, that will have far more people at the table around with respect to the discussion.
I'm just trying to determine in these very, very rural counties, how is it that you're going to, if you don't go through the schools and you don't go through the county commission, how is it, what groups exactly are you bringing together?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, Representative Wisnett. What we've done is, you know, in many cases when we're out in the very, very small communities, there are other agencies and entities in those communities, for example, Boys and Girls Clubs. We've gone to the Boys and Girls Clubs around this state, and I tell you, as we've engaged parents with respect to Boys and Girls Clubs, they are saying that if it were not for Boys and Girls Clubs, they do not know what they would do. And so they have been a beacon in small communities, and they have been the support. So we engage those Boys and Girls Clubs and have we've identified the other mechanisms, in other words, in the community that could actually be at the table and be the backbone organizations for some of this. But it does not preclude your state, your county governments, your other nonprofits, your school districts from being at the table. They all need to be at the table.
Thank you, Iris. And we obviously have a lot more questions, and we'll take more time. And if, again, if you could talk with our committee administrator to see when would be a good time for you to come in February, we'll give you more time so we can make sure everybody's questions are answered and their concerns addressed. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming today. So we are, Pam, was Pam here? Pam Martin? Yes, thanks, Pam. Good to be there. And so I know you're going to be talking with us about the U.S. Department of Justice report on integration of mental health services. What I'd like to, because you'll be talking in the next panel also, what I'd like to do is to invite the full panel up. And so I'm asking that a fourth chair be brought up here, and so that everybody, Pam Martin, Greg Roberts, Janet, Juliet, I mean, and Follinsby and Cindy Becker, because Julia, I hope nobody has any more slides.
good.
Thank you. And could somebody pull up the screen and open up the lines? I hate feeling like we live in a cave. It seems to me this is all of a piece. What happens both in the community and mental health services? What happens in people going into the hospital? What happens with people leaving the hospital? So rather than having each presenter, what I'm hoping to present, I'm hoping that we can talk about the whole issue of the mentally ill, and especially, I think, addressing the U.S. Department of Justice concerns in the report that came out on January 2nd, which, incidentally, was my birthday. And talking about that and how it affects the services that we're providing now and hopefully what we'll be providing in the future. Also, I think most of us were here, or maybe not, at least three of us were still here when we passed the legislation several years ago about formalizing the process for people being admitted into the hospital and then hopefully opening up the door so that people can leave the hospital and hopefully providing more services within the community so that fewer people will be going into the hospital. So I'd like sort of an update on those issues, and this is going to be not just the group here, but I'm hoping, and I'm sure that Representative Greenlick, that's one of the reasons you're here, is that you and I both have a special interest in mental health issues and in the state hospital. So again, welcome very much, and what I'm going to ask you to do is introduce yourselves, and then we'll have a brief presentation you have. But I'm hoping we will have probably as much time as we need here. We've got another presentation after this. But I want us to have enough information so that we come into the February session, we sort of know where we are regarding those issues and where we're going, especially regarding the U.S. Department of Justice concerns about community mental health.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent at the Oregon State Hospital.
Thank you.
I'm Cindy Becker. I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pam Martin. I'm the Director of Addictions and Mental Health for the Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Representative Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Juliet Follansbee. I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
And this is the first time that Juliet has been before our committee, and welcome. We're happy to see you.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei, Chair, and members of the committee, if I may just start by giving a brief overview of the U.S. DOJ report. As you know, in November of 2012, the state entered into a four-year agreement with U.S. DOJ concerning services for people with severe and persistent mental illness. And on January 2nd, they released an interim report, which was their preliminary analysis of the year one baseline data, which included three data points, essentially, three quarters of data at that time. The data does not reflect yet the significant investment that the Oregon legislature made in the community mental health system, and we expect that the numbers of people served is going to improve as new services and programs come online in 2014. We share with U.S. DOJ a commitment to serve people with severe and persistent mental illness, and we
you can move a little bit away from the there.
Perfect. And we want people to be living in least restrictive city settings. So we didn't wait to make changes, and last summer, Governor Kitzcover and the legislature made unprecedented investments in mental health services, and many of these are going to directly, positively impact people with severe and persistent mental illness. For example, crisis services, supported housing, and peer-delivered services, supported employment, especially assertive community treatment, ACT teams, and jail diversion. These are all things that have a great impact on that particular population. These funds will fund provider training, technical assistance, the establishment of programs, and helping people recover from mental illness. Now, at the same time, I think Greg may talk more about this, but we are reducing our reliance on the state hospital system. Over the past 10 years, the average daily population of the state hospital has decreased by about 20%. So it was at a high of 784 people in 2004 and down to 629 people in 2013. We want to, of course, continue to reduce admissions to the state hospital, get people integrated care, and have their stays be as brief as possible. So I wanted to report that we met with USDOJ for 2 days on January 8th and January 9th, and this was after the report had been released. The meetings were very productive. One of the most important goals we had was to look at the data that had been set up in this matrix a year previously and to make sure we were getting the information that we needed. They had a consultant named Dr. Linda Redmond, and we had looked at the data very carefully. Their consultant came in, and they came in with a number of changes they wanted to see. We came in with many pages of changes where we said, we think there's a better way to collect this information that will really get the information. And we found, fortunately, a great number of places of overlap where they had the same suggestions that we had about improving the data. Some of it's very technical, but some of it's very commonsensical. We shouldn't, for example, we should not be looking at data from the state hospital as an aggregate. We should look at the people who are there for forensic evaluations, separate from the people who are there for a civil commitment, separate from people who are there for GEI, separate from the geriatric population. That data had been aggregated, for example. So there are many.
GEI is guilty except for insanity. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yes. So improvements such as that will give us a much better look. So we propose changes. We're currently working on revising some of the data collection elements. And we were also able to, I think, give them a full picture about the transformation of healthcare in Oregon. People with SBMI, as I'm sure you're aware, have a people with severe and persistent mental illness live about 25 to 30 years less than an average American. They have really severe health problems. And what we talked to them about was the transformation of the system here so that people's physical as well as mental health needs are being met. And we talked to them about the outcomes that we're looking for through the coordinated care organizations. And we also shared information about the new leadership at Addictions and Mental Health, about the different investments that we are making that are going to directly impact people with severe mental illness. They also weren't aware that we were working with several centers of excellence. We have a center of excellence in Oregon for assertive community treatment, which is the intensive case management for people with severe mental illness. We also work with a center for supported employment. We also have a program that I may talk a little more about called Adult Mental Health Services Unit, which is, the acronym is AIM High, which has gotten very good results in reducing the amount of time that people wait for discharge from the state hospital. And they didn't realize that we are creating an Office of Consumer Activities within Addictions and Mental Health, along with our Consumer Advisory Board, that will bring consumer voice to the table at the executive team level at Addictions and Mental Health. So we also are making dramatic improvements in our data collection system. So we had a number of new projects to talk to them about, and they expressed some confidence in going forward, and I think it was a very collaborative and collegial meeting. So according to the agreement, in the next year, we're scheduled to focus on identifying gaps in the service system. During year three, outcome measures are supposed to be developed, although I think we're in the process of developing many of them now. And then the last year is designed to focus on the outcomes. Oregon is one of seven states that was chosen to participate in an Olmsted Policy Academy that focused on how to serve people with severe and persistent mental health issues in the community. So we have, we let the US DOJ know that Oregon had been participating in that national dialogue.
Olmsted, could you repeat the name of that again?
O-L-M-S-T.
I know how to spell
it. Oh, I'm sorry. Olmsted Policy Academy.
Okay.
Sponsored in part by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
And
nationally.
For those who are fairly new to the committee, could you talk some about the Olmsted Act?
Yeah, the Olmsted Act is a civil rights issue, and really basically is to make sure that people are at the right level of care and aren't in overly restrictive settings. So the Olmsted Act nationally has really increased the dialogue and the efforts to get people out of institutions and into community living at whatever supported level or with whatever supported services are needed for them. So we are scheduled to meet with the United States DOJ again in March, and we expect to continue to work collaboratively with them and providers and consumers and advocates and their families. So that's just an overview of that report. We're going through it very carefully and responding and thinking about their suggestions, and I think mainly in the improvements, the joint improvements that we're making in the data collection will really tell the story. So with that, let me turn
I'm going to ask if anybody has any questions or concerns. We had sent you electronically the report of the Department of Justice, and I'm not sure if I printed mine out. I noticed on page 2, that in the executive summary, that they said community services have not begun to expand. Oregon is not yet transitioning to a community-based system. The funding for mental health services is not yet shifting away from costly, restrictive institutional settings to more effective, less costly community services. So that's pretty critical. And the other part of that is when you're talking about data, that their data is not similar to your data, that it's different. Can you explain to us why they would get different data from you?
No, I don't. I'm sorry if I gave the impression, Representative Tomei and members of the committee, that the data was different. What was developed was a matrix of information that they would have, and this was done in November of 2012. After collecting 3/4 of the data, it was very clear that some of it was not getting to the information that they wanted. So we sent them the information, and then they put it in tables and sent it back. And then for 2 days, a couple weeks ago, we all sat and looked at it, and we'd all looked at it individually and said, well, this does not give an accurate picture of this particular issue. So, for example, how many people are being served by assertive community teams? So we discussed how that data was collected, if there are better ways to find that out, what would show the real picture. There should be 50.
And you provide the data for them, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We provide the information. So we mutually agreed upon places where we could improve the information. There were One important thing that we're working on is a clear data dictionary. Some of this information we gather by sending out surveys to our community mental health providers. And one concern we have is that we haven't been clear enough about what we're asking. So if we say, you know, how many red cats do you have, but they didn't know what to do with an orange cat, so they didn't count that cat. I mean, it's we need to be much clearer, and this is a process, I believe, because some of these data are not things that we normally collect. And we don't normally collect them in this way. And we're also in the middle of bringing up a data system called, I don't know what the acronym stands for. It's called MOTS. It's a Compass program, and it's been developed at Addictions and Mental Health to collect all the non-Medicaid grant-based funding and general fund encounters. So that's I don't know if that was helpful.
Representative Gelsing?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. When I was looking through the materials, it talked about some of the challenges with the data, including that the crisis line numbers, there was no way for Oregon to unduplicate, to provide unduplicated data about the number of people that had called. And so I wondered what your sense would be in looking at this number. I consistently have a difficult time helping constituents access mental health services in my community. Just within the last week, I had to personally call the crisis line multiple times to be able to get any support for an individual who was a risk to herself and others. Was flat out told that our community doesn't do mobile crisis, and the best choice would be to take this person to the emergency room or call the police. So my question is, one, how many of my calls counted as individual calls for service? And two, if we really are rolling this out, how come people in my community can't access services and my county mental health program says we don't do community-based crisis services, call the emergency room or the police?
Well, several Representative Gelser, members of the committee, those are several very excellent questions. The first question is about counting crisis line calls. And since there are 43 or 45 different crisis lines in Oregon right now, I believe they collect information differently at every one. And that's a very good example of need of a number that appears in a report that we are not sure exactly what's being counted. We certainly know people are using crisis lines, but I couldn't tell you if your call was counted as one encounter or however many times you called. So the fact that we have that many crisis lines, I believe, may also be an issue. And we are discussing that as well. But depending on the sophistication they're independently run, so it's difficult to know.
Are there any crisis lines in the state where when you call in a crisis, it leads to a service rather than spending 45 minutes a lot of times on hold to eventually be told to call 911?
I believe, Representative Gelser and members of the committee, I believe that there are crisis lines where the crisis lines are connected to mobile crisis units. It's quite variable across the state. I can tell you we have, at Addictions and Mental Health, we've called every crisis line, but to get not as a secret shopper, but just to have a staff call, just to see if they're functional, if somebody answers the phone, but we have not looked into the quality of service that you're talking about in terms of what is offered by each line.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I thought one of the shocking things to me in the report on the variety of quality of service is on page 11 and 12, the caseloads, where some teams have an average caseload of zero, and then Marion County has 527. Could you just address how you might be meeting that challenge?
Yes. Representative and members of the committee, I believe this information is incorrect. I believe we've not asked these teams the right questions. So in order to sort this out, I'm meeting with the Assertive Community Team Center of Excellence on January 30th. We have a list of every assertive community team in the state. There are perhaps 19 now, and we're adding, I believe, 10, and some of those will be enhancements of existing teams. And we're going to talk to the Center of Excellence about how we count the number of people who are being served on these teams. The normal number is somewhere between 30 and 100. And so these data are incorrect. So we're going to talk to the Center of Excellence about how the right questions to be asking the teams. If a team is only seeing one person, they're not an assertive community team, which is a very expensive team to put together. It has a psychiatrist, has a nurse, it has a social worker, has a psychologist, it has a peer and family specialist. It's a very defined set of people, and if they're seeing 500, then they're not an assertive community team either, because that's too many people. So we hope to get accurate information about this extremely important evidence-based service.
Any other questions? Representative Olson and I have been involved in this issue for many years, and I guess that movie.
Groundhog Day.
Doesn't it feel that way? It feels like we've been hearing this for years and years and years. And yeah. As you can probably tell by my affect, I am very concerned about this report. I'm very concerned about what we're hearing. I'm very concerned that we're not moving away from institutionalization. And I understand what you're saying, that some of the people in the state hospital are there for aid and assist. I understand, but it's still an institution. And we will be hearing more from community services and from PSRB. But, I'm sorry, Pam, that you're sort of taking the brunt of this, and I'm sorry for that. But I just want to express, as someone who's worked on these issues as well as Representative Greenlich, that I'm very concerned about this. Representative Greenlich.
I must say, I guess as a researcher, I'm very frustrated. I think I've been involved with efforts to get the data correct at least 30 years.
Yeah.
And I just can't understand why we can't figure out how to get the data on mental health services in this state correct. I mean, it was clear looking that 540 is not a right number. Something's wrong. But are we ever going to get it right?
Chair and Representative Greenlich and committee, I believe our best the best effort that we have right now is our new MOT system. The problem has been gathering non-Medicaid funding in behavioral health is a mishmash of general fund, time-limited grants, the block grant, you know, all these things that you are all aware of. And every single one of the funding sources wants a different, slightly different kind of data set. Putting this all together and making it encounter-based, I believe we'll be able to get a much fuller picture. I believe you should be seeing information from us within the next 6 months that will be encouraging.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you for coming. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the accountability for the delivery of services, it seems like community-based mental health services on the ground is the purview of the counties. How much authority does the Oregon Health Authority have to hold county mental health departments accountable, and what tools do we have to create some consistency across the state, whether it's in the collection of data and how we define things or in the actual determination of services?
Representative Gelser and members of the committee, I can give you two examples of where we're headed in that direction. One is that there are performance requirements that the coordinated care organizations have. At this point, a lot around screening and early detection of adolescent depression, for example, and alcohol programs. So that's a very important step. That's accountability within the coordinated care organizations. And I can also tell you that we, with the new investments, the new mental health investments that were appropriated, you know, by the legislature, have been treated very differently than they have been in the past. The process to get this money out was a request for proposal process, and it was a competitive grants, rather than just assuming that we would send it out by, you know, typical regular channels. And right now my staff is engaged in contract talks with all of the awardees, and as part of that the contract talks, the performance requirements will be within the contracts. I think that's a different approach. So those are two points where I can say that this is holding systems accountable for outcomes.
Representative,
thank you. I'd just like to make a comment. It's my understanding that the county I come from has the highest per capita commitment to the Oregon State Hospital, and we have one psychiatrist for a county that is the fourth largest in the state of Oregon. And so I'm very concerned that we do not have mental health services that are adequate in any capacity in a lot of these rural areas. And per capita, we have very, very large numbers of individuals with chronic mental health problems. So, I mean, I don't know how we can work this out any better, but the psychiatrists simply don't want to come to these rural areas because they can't make the kind of money that they can in Portland, you know. So I don't know how we get around this, but we just have really bad problems in these Eastern Oregon areas.
Representative Winsett, members of the committee, I agree completely about the lack of psychiatric coverage for rural and frontier areas in particular. We are doing one thing that will help on the child front. We are finally going forward with a program that links a child psychiatrist to primary care physicians and pediatricians. It's called the OPAL-K Project. It's been in the works for many years and is finally getting going. So I believe that it's going to be programs such as that will ultimately assist, because I agree, there are not enough psychiatrists anywhere, and they're not going to be moving. And so we're looking at ways to support the primary care, pediatricians, nurse practitioners in treating people medically. Telemedicine and telehealth, I think, are going to play a huge role in the future in underserved areas, and not only in psychiatry, but in other areas of specialization, such as pain management, which is something else that's very difficult for providers on the ground.
And it's not, of course, just a psychiatrist who need those kinds of wraparound services to support people who are having a mental health crisis.
We don't have any, essentially.
We'll hear from Cindy about what kind of crisis programs we have in any community. And it's very discouraging to me that I was sick and I was going through lots of papers, and I found materials where you and I met years and years ago about just these same kinds of issues. We need crisis beds. We need crisis services. I mean, it's very distressing to hear that you're on hold for a very long period of time. Can you imagine somebody's going through a crisis that they can't find help? immediately. It is.
Well, and Madam Chair, beyond being on hold for a long period of time, the person on the phone not knowing the hours of the walk-in crisis, after all of this time, they said they were going to put me in touch with a manager, put me on hold again, came back and said they couldn't find anyone. Would I be willing to leave a voicemail and maybe somebody would call me back the next day? It was that. I was not having a personal crisis when I called the mental health crisis line, but I felt like I was having one by the time I hung up because it was so unbelievably frustrating.
That is very, very discouraging. So I'm hoping that you will come back to us later in February and sort of addressing some of these issues that we're bringing up. And I think I had asked staff to alert you that we would be asking some of these questions. Thanks. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment, Madam Chair, that you know, we heard this morning various bills being introduced with regard to vulnerable populations, seniors and children and so on. And you know, I just want to draw attention to the fact that our mentally ill, I mean, it's just, as you said, 30 years and we're still just not addressing the issues as we should be. And I hope that this body can maybe develop a task force, work group, whatever, to begin really addressing some of these issues and work with this great body that's here in front of us, this panel.
Are you volunteering, Mr. Senator?
Sure. I mean, I'd be happy to work with somebody.
Great.
Thank you.
And we keep coming back to funding, and I guess it's just startling. I've been hearing that it costs $250,000 to keep somebody in the hospital, the state hospital. Now, their report was that it was $345,000. Did I say $40 million? Yeah, $435,000. And before we move off, Pam, I'm sorry you're on the hot seat, but I think some of us who know about the Olmstead Act and know about Fairview know what the consequences, the dire consequences might be if we don't meet the requirements of the U.S. Department of Justice. So just briefly, could you alert the committee to that?
What the consequences might be?
If we don't.
Okay. Representative Tomei, in other states that have not successfully manage their agreement. There is often a very prescriptive settlement with monitors and a long, a long period of oversight.
And when this first came up some years ago, probably the three of us at least will remember that, what that was like, and the threat of that. And I think this happened in Hawaii. The expense comes out of the general fund. It doesn't matter if you say, well, that isn't really what we want to spend. It will come out.
When the California prison system didn't meet the DOJ agreement on health care, the feds took it over and just billed the state.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's indeed what could happen with us. This is one of the reasons that I am so concerned about that, that we're not moving out, even though they keep saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. Somehow we don't do it. And it's so frustrating to me. It makes me very upset.
Makes you crazy.
It does make me crazy. like Richard Kelter was saying when she was on the phone. Oh, I feel like, Pam, we've beat you up enough. But you can see what our concerns are, and we would like you to come back in February to address some of these. So who would like to go next?
Yeah, we're interested.
But if you want to talk about the state hospital in the process of leaving, or you want to talk about the community, it's up to
the
committee.
Let's talk some about the state hospital and then go to PSRB and then maybe community services. Thank you, Cindy.
Okay. Thank you. I've been thinking, Representative Tomei is on our hospital advisory board. We have conversations on some of these issues on a pretty regular basis. And I think what can be helpful in the context of the USDOJ and Olmstead discussion is to step back for just a moment and think about the role of the state hospital in the spectrum of mental health services in the state. We have a particular mission that we're for several years now, we believe we've been performing much better to our mission. And basically, our mission is to admit people from the community whose needs cannot be met in the community and then provide them with the treatment in the state hospital that permits them to return successfully to the community. And that's what we do. And I know many members of the committee have been to the hospital, and you've seen the programs and the treatment walls and the things that we do to fulfill our mission, to get people stable and ready to return to the community. So that is the essence of this discussion. There is a direct relationship that it's worth thinking consciously about. To the extent that, let me just say this, I was on recently a national panel from the National Association of State Mental Hospitals that's writing a position paper on the role of psychiatric hospitals in the 21st century. And a question came up from a number of states, how do you calculate how many state hospital beds a particular state may need? And people spent a little bit of time looking at population and population growth forecasts and prevalence of mental illness, including severe mental illness. And after only a few minutes, it became clear that's the wrong way to approach the question. How many beds a state needs in their state hospital system depends entirely on the level of development of a community mental health system. So that if a state does not have a robust community mental health system, you'll need a lot of state hospital beds, because that's where people will have to go for their treatment. And to the extent that a state does have a robust community mental health system, you need fewer state hospital beds because the people don't need to be admitted, because their treatment needs can be met in the community. And then when they come to the state hospital and receive the treatment they require, they have opportunities to be successful again in the community. So I think, from my point of view, that's where this discussion is centered right now. The question on the table is to what extent community services in Oregon need to be developed and how they need to be developed so that some people who are currently being admitted to the state hospital would be able to have their treatment needs met in the community and not be admitted. And for the people who do come to the hospital who are then stabilized and able to return, have places to be discharged to expeditiously. So we do need the data, and we have quite a bit of the data on the state hospital side in terms of people who are ready to place and what their treatment needs are in the community, and that data is being used to help identify what the RFPs need to look like, what type of services need to be developed in the community so that people can leave, which is the essence of the Olmstead Supreme Court decision. That people should not be institutionalized in the most restrictive setting when they are not in need of that level of care. So it's exactly what we're working on presently.
So Greg, give us a couple of figures. We heard that the figures that the DOJ had were incorrect. So how many patients are total in the hospital, including the aid and assist?
Currently, today, a little over 600.
600. Total in the Salem Hospital, and there are people in Portland, and is everybody out of Pendleton?
I'm sorry, Representative Tomei and members of the committee. No, that's the entire system. In Salem, there are about 530 patients. In Portland, there are about 70, and I'm not sure of the census currently in Blue Mountain.
Okay.
So, four.
Okay, and how many of those are aid and assist? About
aid and assist in the state hospital right now is about 150.
150, and colleagues, do you know what that is? That's when someone is not ready to go to court, and they're going through this process so that they can assist in their own defense if they have committed a crime. And then PSRB?
About 265.
Okay.
Which is record low.
It is.
Yeah. Right. Good. If you could stand a positive comment.
Please do.
There has been progress made on in those areas. The number of PSRB, GEI patients in the hospital has been decreasing. The number of admissions of that population has been decreasing. The length of stay for civil patients has been decreasing. That aid and assist 370 population is actually our most problematic issue right now, and we're beginning to deal with that as well. So it's I wouldn't want to not mention that progress has been made with some of the populations. We've reduced our geriatric population. We did close one of our geriatric units earlier this year in October. So many of the things that we have talked about in the past have come to fruition. Yet these other issues do remain. The people, as we look to develop the community system and avoid the admission for people whose needs can be met in the community, that's what we want to do. And in doing that, you also solve a backdoor issue, developing places for people to be successfully discharged to. So.
Is it easier to put the civilly committed folks in the community than it is the PSRB folks?
Representative Tomei, members of the committee, I would say easy. Yes, the answer is yes. From the point of view that there are fewer steps involved in the process, for a civilly committed patient to be designated as ready to place, the only thing that's required is the patient's treatment team, psychiatrist, social worker, nursing, etc., to declare that the person is ready to leave the hospital, and then we work in collaboration with community providers to facilitate a placement. For the GEI population, it's a three-step process, actually four. The treatment team has to say the person's ready to leave. They go through a double-check process, a risk review panel, we call it, within the hospital. Then the board, either the state hospital review panel or the PSRB, has to agree, and then we make a referral to a community program. So, yes, civilly committed is less complicated than the GEI.
Thank you. So. Representative Greenlick.
Yes, as I remember the numbers correctly, we recently had about 650,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan. We added 150,000 this month, so we now have 800,000 people. Almost all of them are going to be seen by CCOs. Is there any financial incentive for CCOs to keep people out of the state hospital? Or is it in their financial interest to get rid of them and send them to Salem?
At this point, there's no financial incentive around the state hospital for CCOs. Now, the counties, you know, we have had a co-management plan, which is really pretty much inactive. But I think I could say that that's never been a discussion item at the CCOs, and there's nothing in their global budgets.
I'm so glad you asked that question.
It's because something you and I need to be talking about.
That was just amazing to me yesterday when we heard from Mr. Hetherington that they did not get any money for wraparound services.
Well, not only that, but it's in their I think they have an incentive to send patients to the state hospital because then they don't have to be responsible for them.
Exactly.
And I don't know how much that's happening or not, but it's something we both committees need to be very much attuned to.
Yes, I agree.
Oh, wait.
Any other questions as we move on? Okay, thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate that. And the other thing we need is housing. We're going to be hearing more about housing in just a few minutes. We need housing for these folks if they're leaving.
Okay. Yes. Great. I'm Juliet Follinsby, Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, also known as the PSRB. For those of you that are unfamiliar with the PSRB and our clientele, we assume responsibility, supervision, and monitoring of those that have successfully asserted the insanity defense. So they have been charged with a felony, typically an A felony, and has been placed under our board's jurisdiction in lieu of pleading guilty and going the corrections route. We have existed since the late 70s.
In lieu of being convicted of that felony.
Correct. So a guilty except for insanity, also known as GEI, is considered not a conviction, and it's always up to the client whether or not to assert the insanity defense. So those clients are placed under our jurisdiction. Right now we have, as Superintendent Roberts stated, we have about 163 of our clients. There's about a little less than 100 of SHARP clients in the Oregon State Hospital. SHARP is State Hospital Review Panel. So those individuals that are GEI patients in the hospital that have committed non-Measure 11 offenses are placed under the Oregon Health Authority's jurisdiction while they're at the state hospital. We have the highest rate of clients living outside of the hospital than we ever have. So right now it's about 68% of our total PSRB population are receiving services in the community, which is an all-time high. If we include the SHARP clients, still well over half of the GEI population in this state is living outside of the state hospital. So when we get to housing, certainly I think it's important to reiterate the needs, the specific housing needs of our clients.
Can I just ask a clarification question? Is the GEI population, can you use that interchangeably with the PSRB, or is it a subset?
Representative Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, GEI population could include individuals that are either under the PSRB or SHARP, depending on where they're housed. Mm-hmm. So the PSRB will assume jurisdiction of all GEI clients once they're out in the community. But if they're residing in the hospital, they're either going to be under the PSRB or SHARP, depending on the crime that they committed.
And say the crime again.
Measure 11, they will all, those clients will always be under the PSRB.
Oh.
Non-Measure 11 will only be under the Oregon Health Authority while they're in the hospital. And then once they're conditionally released, then the jurisdiction transfers back to us. Yeah. So our clients, our primary purpose is public safety. The board recognizes that that is not inconsistent with having a patient-centered model of treatment. Our goal is to have our treatment providers engage our clients. You know, we have our clients at the tail end of the system when the 911 call center has failed and they didn't get the help they need. And I think that the fact that the legislature has made the jurisdictional length of time under our jurisdiction, it's the maximum amount of time that you would have spent had you been convicted of the crime. So our clients remain under our jurisdiction for long periods of time, and I think the everyone's goal is to ensure that our clients receive the treatment and support they need to eventually become independent, healthy, and safe, so there's not a repeat of what brought them under the board to begin with. We have a couple recent additions in the last 6 or 7 years. We have a juvenile panel now, so we now consist of a 5-member adult panel and a 5-member juvenile panel. The adult panel and juvenile both have a psychiatrist, psychologist, attorney with an expertise in criminal law, probation officer, and then a public member. The board conducts its mission primarily through a hearings process and then also internal process with our community providers and the Oregon State Hospital. The board, you know, and it all goes with the community resources. Since most of our clients are now out in the community, the board recently has made efforts to utilize the resources that are available. So in order to avoid revocations, which really is our only legal mechanism to send somebody back to the hospital, we're attempting to use some of our vacancies to maybe step up a client in residential care in order to avoid a revocation and send them back to the hospital just because simply they're having a medication change. You know, some of our clients in crises don't necessarily need hospital care. So we've been working with our community providers to create a system for what I kind of call respite services. Short-term stays, maybe 2 to 3 weeks, so that medication adjustment can be done in a safe, secure manner and then have the client return to the residence. I think, A, it minimizes vacancy and then, of course, helps with the census at the hospital. We're also seeing some of the benefits of some of the funding that the legislature has given regarding rental assistance, master lease programs. We're seeing more and more clients able to step down to the lower level of care, such as what we call the intensive case management, where you're able to live in your own apartment, and you have that wraparound services or ACT team that is available to you, but you can live with the independence of your own home. And we're seeing, since 2005, the legislature has funded more of those sort of programs, and that's allowing our clients to step down to a lower level of care, which then allows openings for maybe someone to leave from the hospital faster. And I think our data that shows that we have the most amount of clients ever on conditional release, you know, the funding of those lower level of care, I think, is really helping the clients move through the system. For our particular population, the data suggests that the most successful clients, GEI clients that live at the independent level, are ones where they've slowly moved down the residential level of care. So they might have started off at a 24/7 residential treatment home, moved to semi-independent, and then down into independent. So certainly that's sort of the pattern that our clients utilize as they enter into the community.
And I'm assuming you do provide those kinds of wraparound services to make sure that they can safely go from one level to another.
Absolutely. And none of those decisions are done without their current treatment team supporting that and then recommending that. Okay. Absolutely. We're also continuing our 30-year history of recidivism. I gave a two-sheet kind of fact sheet for those that just kind of give a snapshot. We, unlike corrections, have maintained under 3% recidivism rate. And I think that goes to the credit of the community providers that are, you know, day in and day out ensuring our clients are safe and are at the appropriate level of care. When we get to the housing, I mean, it's always about funding, I guess, for housing. But I think, you know, if we want to continue with that safety record and with public safety in mind, which is our primary focus, as we have more of our clients in the community, it seems to me that that's where, for the PSRB resources, that's where the funding needs to be focused on.
Thank you, Juliet. Any questions? Representative Greenland.
I have two questions, if I may, and I need to leave shortly. The first is perhaps the reason you have so many people in the independent living piece, because it's hard to get out of that piece. Is there a way out when people are ready to be unsupervised? That's question one. And the second question is, how many people do you have in the hospital that you're prepared to release into community settings that you can't find community settings for?
Representative Tomei, Representative Greenlick, I'll start with the second question first. I pulled our report that would tell me the list of clients who have been found appropriate for conditional release pending bed availability, and there were 7 on the list. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact that 2 of them are waiting for a specific bed because of their special needs. You know, we have, that's the trend with our housing. We have special need facilities now. So it might be a medically enhanced facility. It might be a facility or program that focuses on traumatic brain injury. So those 2 clients are waiting for a specific bed. And the rest of the clients have either had mental health crisis since that finding was made, or are refusing to accept the placement that was offered. So 2 would be my answer that are ready to go and waiting for a bed. The first question, for some clarification, are you asking regarding discharge from jurisdiction, so individuals are no longer under the client board's jurisdiction? Our discharge statutory mandate is pretty clear that it's very narrow, that the board shall not discharge anyone if they continue to have a mental illness, that when it's active, they can be a substantial danger to others. So even if a client's doing very well on conditional release, living independently, employed, which many of our clients are doing, the discharge criteria is very limiting. given that even if the client's doing really well, the board is not allowed to discharge unless there's medical evidence that when that disease is active, they're no longer a substantial danger to others. So I hope that answers your question.
Wait, may I follow up?
Follow up?
Yeah, no, that confuses me because that would say if they were found guilty except for insanity because they had an active mental illness problem, now they've gone all the way through this and it says, well, if they get that one back, there'll be, I mean, it's a circular definition. It would be basically automatic, wouldn't it? I mean, it would say, okay, if you ever got back what put you here, you're in danger, so therefore we can never let you out. I think it's you just said that.
Representative Tomei, Representative Greenlech, you know, I think I can tell you we've discharged individuals. I think we had 55 discharges last year. Most were due to end of jurisdiction, but the board does discharge for individuals that no longer are a substantial danger to others. And really it comes down to the specific diagnoses and maybe assessments or data or the progress of the individual that can show that even when the mental illness is active, they're no longer a substantial danger to others. So I don't want to mislead the committee that we never discharge. There are certain diagnoses that sometimes become clearer as they remain under the board's jurisdiction. So what looked like maybe a schizophrenia diagnosis when they committed the crime, after being sober for 4 years with no symptoms, not needing any medication, sometimes the diagnoses change to meth-induced psychosis. And as you may or may not know, those that are solely drug-induced psychosis or alcohol, that is not a qualifying Access 1 diagnosis to remain under the board. So the board would discharge in that case. So certainly the board does discharge, but it is a very narrow definition.
Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me to sit.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate that. And we need to make sure that our two committees are working on this in ways that facilitate.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
And
thank
I'm
you,
hoping you're going to be asking the CCOs more about the safety net.
Oh, yeah.
And also, they're going to be getting the residential programs, I think, in July, right?
Yes,
they'll be getting residential programs in July. Can you wait and listen to Cindy? Maybe Cindy can talk some about that.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that would be a question that would be asked in your committee. Thank you. Cindy, move ahead.
Thank you. I'm, for the record, Cindy Becker, Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. I'm speaking also on behalf of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. What I was going to talk about and listening to the committee is changed a little bit. The first thing I wanted to mention is the fact that we are working, I think, quite successfully with our CCO partners. A point in fact to your question, there is no language in statute, there is no language really in contract that really speaks to incentives or disincentives. I think what you'll see across the state is primarily CCOs are working with their mental health partners who have historically been managing the local mental health systems, so with counties and with providers. And part of that is just because of the amount of change that's happening, and I think there is with all of the different things they're doing, they really are relying on the mental health partners who have been managing the system, you know, for all this time. And certainly the contracts that the community mental health programs have with the state, I think it's important to remember that, and well, I know this committee does, but people who have been fortunate enough to be on OHP and people who have not look the same. They're the same people. And so many of the providers that we contract with are the same entities. And so their money may be coming through a CCO or their money may be coming through the state. But what we're trying to do is have a seamless system. I think in terms of the incentives or disincentives, you know, the counties and the providers,
there, by and large, I would say that we all want to see people who are ready to place out of the state hospitals in the community. The question becomes one of resources, quite honestly. You know, when my hair was one color, I worked on the Fairview closure plan way back when. And I can tell you that there were millions and millions and millions of dollars put into the community. And so while we certainly thank the legislature and appreciative of the funds that were appropriated last session, it's just a start. If you're really looking at a sea change from the state hospital to the community, you're looking at a lot more money. I think what the legislature did last session was great. However, it's important to understand it didn't fix the issue. If you look at any of the line items where those funds were appropriated, none of those can fund that service across the state. And so I think part of that reason, and part because the state wanted to look at a different way of allocating those dollars, we have gone through an RFP process. And what I have for you is to date where those dollars have been awarded. Can you give that? Thank you. I love when the superintendent does stuff. And these are dollars that are building upon what's in the community. But you will see that there are many gaps. And again, it's not right or wrong. It just is. The resources available are not sufficient to go across the community. If you look at crisis services, I think there were double the amount of requests in the RFP for crisis services than there was money to award. If you look at housing, there were 18 responses for supported housing. There was only sufficient money to award to 8 of those respondents. So it's not like we don't know what the need is. I think it's a question of how those dollars come to the state and then come to communities. Some of those dollars have been awarded to counties. Some of those, if you look on the back where their asterisks are, some of those dollars have been awarded directly to community partners. So I think it's, you know, I think for years we've all been braiding dollars. We've been braiding whether it's county general funds or state general funds or Medicaid dollars or block grant dollars because there's not been sufficient money in any of those. We have been braiding them. In terms of, I can just give you an example, with Cover Oregon, with the Medicaid expansion for Clackamas County, we were just informed that there are 4,000 more people who are now covered, that have a mental health benefit in Clackamas County. What we don't know is how many of those 4,000 people are currently being served today, and what we also don't know is what is the level of care needs for those individuals who are not being served, and is there enough money for that. So there's still, you know, so we're getting some numbers, but there's a great unknown in terms of what those folks look like. We do know that individuals who are coming on to health plans, and I know, Representative, you're fully aware of that, their needs are going to be higher because they haven't had the addictions treatment services. They haven't had the mental health services unless they're in crisis. And so it's going to take us a little while to sort that out. The fabulous news is that they have coverage, but there's a great unknown about what those needs are going to be. These dollars are great. They're not enough. I'll just tell you, they're not enough to cover the needs, as clearly have been expressed by the responses. Plus, I think it's important to understand that even those respondents were not able to get all the money in many cases that they requested because of the amount of money available. I think the state tried to get out as much as they could across the state. These dollars have not been contracted yet. It's been a complicated process for everybody involved, and so we're probably looking at a March or April time before those dollars actually come out.
That money was allocated in May, right?
At the last session, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it's a new way of doing business. It's a complicated way, and I think we're all trying to step up to it. So there's a process issue. There's a quantity issue. I think it's not rocket science. I think we understand what many of the needs are and those have been explained. We certainly are looking at new ways of providing, particularly some of the medication management, which are huge issues, psychiatric services. There are not enough psychiatrists. How do we do that differently? How do we know that our clients with severe and persistent mental illness are not going to walk into a primary care clinic. So how do we bring primary care to those individuals where they are? So I think there's a lot of great information out there. The question is, do you go deep in a couple of areas, like crisis and jail diversion, or do you try to spread out among many areas, which is what the legislature tried to do this last session? And so I think we're constantly trying, the state certainly is trying to balance the money available and the need. So I talked a lot about, and I could probably talk another hour, and I know you don't have that, but I think it's important to understand that these dollars are on top of what the systems have today. I can tell you, certainly for Clackamas County, we have crisis respite services, we have a walk-in crisis clinic, we have mobile crisis, we have peers involved, we have crisis staff.
How many other counties have that, Cindy? You're not just representing Clackamas County, but...
I don't know how many have that. I think I can talk in the metro region, I think that in Washington County, for example, the majority of those crisis dollars are contracted out. Multnomah has a combination. They have their own staff that operate the crisis lines. We have staff on pagers. We're going to Lines for Life because they actually have clinicians that answer the crisis line rather than having to wait for a pager, which to me is like the worst thing you can do. We also have staff that are placed with the sheriff. They actually go out either with the sheriff or they go out on calls and in crisis calls. And so we've invested significant amount of county dollars in that as well. So these services are not without costs, and it gets back to the braiding and how much you can put together. I think that the crisis, and you were there at Centerstone, I don't think there are many of those around the counties, other counties. They're all trying to figure out what resources they can pull together in their own way to get those services.
And we gave the last session $4.2 million for community-based coordinated services for individuals in crisis and mental health, right? And so has any of that been spent? And then we gave another $10 million for adult community mental health services. Oh, and that's coming later in the biennium, isn't it? Okay, thank you. So I guess it's somewhat concerning to me that we allocated money in May and we're still not looking for anything for another some months, right?
Correct.
And it's somewhat disturbing knowing that there's immediate... Why would we have this lag? Can that be explained to us?
After the funds were allocated, we had a number of steps that we had to go through, which involved writing the RFPs, getting the RFPs out to the community, giving them time to respond, putting together review teams. We also had to work with our contracting division and DOJ. I agree, it's a long, laborious, many-step process. And right now, as I said, we're doing contract negotiations because we want to make sure that we are spending the money in the right place. This was a new way of doing business. We're having a lessons learned session. The providers will have a chance to respond as well, and we're going to be working to streamline the process.
Thank you, Pam. Maybe you could come back. Maybe both of you could come back later in February and talk with us, tell us how the program is going. I think we need to move on to the housing, which is certainly another important component of it. Thank you all very much. And Pam, I apologize if we were too rough on you. Thank you for coming. Okay, the next segment will be, thank you, funding for emergency housing. We'll hear from Jana Bird, Scott Cooper, Jess Larson. Is anyone else? So maybe just to, hi Janet, nice to see you again. All right, the more the merrier.
most elected area.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I serve as the convener of the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of about 60 organizations statewide, range of housing providers, local jurisdictions, and just folks in the community advocacy organizations that care about housing resources. We come together as a coalition because we are committed to creating the opportunity that different and affordable housing provides for people to be successful in their lives. We, during the long session, we provided you lots and lots of data about housing needs in Oregon communities. We're not going to repeat all of that today, but I will just say in summary that it's not getting better. It's getting worse, and particularly in the winter, we see increases as folks are struggling to pay not only their rent and other expenses, but heating costs, and then the impacts of the prolonged recession are really starting to hit hard in Oregon communities. So we're seeing more and more people really struggling for housing stability. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here and take a little bit of time just to talk about one of the tools that we have as a state set up to help people stay stable in housing and get back into housing if they've lost housing. We know that that housing is the foundation of success and opportunity for everybody. Without safe, decent, and affordable housing, the basics of life become almost impossible. Work, paying attention in school, parenting, managing an illness. Imagine doing all of that every day while also packing up your belongings and moving from place to place every day. There's actually, as I was driving down this morning, a story on Oregon Public Broadcasting. They had followed a gentleman for a day who is homeless because of his unemployment benefits having run out. He's a writer by trade or by profession. And he talked about how it took him, the reporter talked about how it took him 5 hours to get a shower and get a meal because he had to stand in line to wait for a shower, and he had to work at Sisters of the Road Cafe in order to earn a meal. This is his only meal of the day. But 5 hours, the things that we take for granted every day, getting up, showering, taking, eating breakfast, I can get that done in 20 minutes sometimes. Just the reality of what folks are living with. Many members of our community, as you just heard, struggle also with mental health conditions or maybe struggling with coming out of a domestic violence situation. So the necessity of managing all of these needs simultaneously becomes almost impossible. The good news is that we do know how to address these needs in Oregon communities. We have a couple tools set up by the state. One is called the Emergency Housing Account. One is called the State Homeless Assistance Program. They were created within Oregon Housing and Community Services. They distribute resources across the state to networks of community organizations. The Emergency Housing Account is used primarily for homelessness prevention, but can also be used to get people back into stable housing. So it provides rent assistance. It can provide the money to pay for an application, the money to help people get identification if they've lost their ID somehow, as well as the staff to support people finding and locating housing, finding furnishings, all the things that need to happen to get people back into housing. The State Homeless Assistance Program primarily supports shelters and emergency situations to protect people both from violence and from the weather. Shelters are overwhelmed. Typically, shelters right now across the state are serving 2 times the number of people they would normally have expected to be serving, and they're still turning people away into the cold and into the night. So the Housing Alliance is asking the legislature to allocate $2 million during this session to EHA and SHAP, $1.5 million to EHA, $500,000 to SHAP in one-time money.
And we don't know what those...
I'm sorry, Emergency Housing Account and State Homeless Assistance Program. I apologize.
Thank you. And
what that would do is restore us to funding levels back to 2007 plus inflation. So these accounts have lost investment over the years since 2007. We did see a temporary increase in federal funds, but those funds have all been exhausted, and again we're seeing ongoing demand in our communities. So again, you know, across the state and every community, it looks a little bit different. The network of providers that have come together to try to do this, there's a lot of faith-based involvement, a lot of volunteers that provide meals, that help kids do homework in the shelters, that are gathering food and other supplies for folks. Those systems are overwhelmed right now with need, and we need this investment from the state. So I'm joined today by several colleagues who are going to talk a little bit more about the experiences they're seeing in their communities.
I just want to call attention. We have 20 minutes, so just keep that in mind, please. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Larson. I work at Northwest Pilot Project in Portland, Oregon. I'm grateful and hopeful to be here today to speak to you about affordable housing. I'm really hopeful to hear more and more conversation in amongst my colleagues and in the community in which I work about affordable housing as a real and necessary tool to addressing homelessness, to addressing poverty. More than ever, it is amazing to see what the lack of housing is doing to the community where I live and work, and it is, I think, becoming more clear that it's time to reinvest in our affordable housing infrastructure to support especially the lowest income Oregonians. At Northwest Pilot Project, where I've worked for the last 8 years, we serve people who are low income and 55 years or older throughout Multnomah County. We see and help about 1,500 individuals a year. And we help people who may lose their job and don't know how to pay next month's rent, someone who may become disabled and exhaust their small savings account, run out of family members where they can sleep on couches, and don't know, you know, where they're going to live or how they're going to pay rent. We also work with people who have considerable barriers to housing, like a recent eviction or even untreated mental health symptoms, people who have active addictions that they're working through. And we know how to help individuals with these kinds of barriers get the help they need, the support in place to rebuild a housing reference and get back into housing. But the barrier we are having the biggest problem with is the sheer lack of affordable apartments. That is the biggest barrier to getting housing these days. It's not individuals' history or personal difficulties. It is the lack of apartments available to help an individual move into. When I started this job, if an individual came to me with a modest Social Security income of maybe $800 a month and no recent evictions and no major criminal convictions, I could say to that individual, excellent, we will help you find an apartment, we'll help you pay the deposit, and we can help you move in a probably 2 weeks' time, the amount of time it took to make an application and, you know, get through the various hoops. Now that conversation in my office sounds more like 4 to 6 months' time. And this is why our shelters are overwhelmed, because people with no real barriers to housing, except the lack of housing, are having to stay in shelters for extended periods of time. And then those with, you know, some minor barriers are having to cycle through shelters 2 or 3 times until they can get to subsidized housing in like a year's time. So it's an enormous amount of work. It's becoming harder, and the work takes longer. And yet I am hopeful, because we are talking more and more about how affordable housing is so essential to resolving poverty and to keeping people healthy in their jobs, in their schools, etc. So it's good to be here and talk about that. I brought my client June with me, and I'd like for her to tell some of her story. She came through Northwest Pilot Project this winter for some assistance.
Thank you, Jessica.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative My name is June Johnson. I lived in an apartment for 20 years over in the Kearns neighborhood. I had three landlords. The last landlords were from Wilsonville, so they decided to move us out. They want to renovate the apartments. It was a triplex, and so I had no place to go. It was like the last day I went down to the Northwest Pilot Project, and Jessica interviewed me, and I told her about my story. And after I told her about my story, she gave me references for housing and where to go. And then I got really into emergency crisis because it was like they gave us 60 days to move in the winter, the dead cold winter, and that was really hard for me, and I have arthritis really bad. And so what I did was they helped me move the last day. The apartment manager gave me an extra day, so I moved out, and then I put my stuff in storage. They had movers to move out. Then I paid the $200 for the storage, and then they put me up in the hotel for 3 weeks. And during that time, I was having references and meeting with Jessica to find a place. And then I eventually found a place. And then Jessica organization helped me with moving my stuff in the place and with my deposit, or else I wouldn't have had any place. It was very hard for me to be in this situation after going back to school after 33 years, getting my degree in human services, and find myself being homeless. It was really hard. And I just wanted to let you know that, you know, it feels really nice to have some place that you can call your home and not being in a hotel that that you will send other clients to, that I would have to. I never would have thought that I would have to go to that hotel when I worked for the health department's crisis, that I would send clients there. But to know today that I have my own keys and my own place to stay, and the Lord has blessed me for so many years that I'm not on the streets. I don't have a criminal record. I've never been arrested. I have one daughter that has a master's, and she's at Nike, and I have one grandson. And I'm just blessed, you know, that my family and I we're together, and I got my place again to call home, and which is a success. And without Northwest Project, I wouldn't know what to do. I would probably still be homeless. I don't know where I would be today, in a shelter somewhere. I wouldn't be on my daughter. That would be too much for her and my grandson. And I just want you to please take that in mind about the housing situation. It is an emergency crisis right now at this stage. And then I just want to thank Northwest Pilot Project for their help and love and support and their guidance for helping me, and also the bed that they provided me.
Thank you, June, for coming and sharing your story with us. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you also, June, and I wondered how you found Northwest Pilot Project.
I was referred there. I was talking with some friends, and I knew about it years ago when I had worked with Multnomah County Health Department. And I've heard about it years in the 70s. I heard about it. And so I never thought that I would have to use any of these agencies that I referred people to when I was working at Human Solutions. And so I went there, and I took a chance, and I prayed before I went. I'm a missionary, and things worked out to the best of my ability, and I did what I could to get out of that situation.
Can I follow up with another question?
Follow up, sure.
For Jessica, or maybe Janet. I'm assuming most of the housing that you're trying to find and that you're finding is just less available than before is rental, not home ownership. And I'm wondering how the Section 8
changes that we made last year may have impacted. I'd hope for the positive. It doesn't sound like it. So have you seen any change as a result of that?
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer. Yeah, so actually June has a Section 8 voucher. And this situation may be more particular to Multnomah County, where how the vacancy rate is such an issue. But finding an apartment that fits within the affordable criteria set by Section 8 is a very hard thing to do, and that is why it took June the 2 months on her own plus another month with the assistance of Northwest Pilot Project to find an apartment that she could use her Section 8 voucher at. There are still landlords saying they don't accept Section 8. I think that is changing as they anticipate the change in the law, and that's great. However, the issue is the lack of affordable housing where Section 8 vouchers can be utilized.
Thank you. Brian, you want to tie it all up?
Yes, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. You may notice that I am not Scott Cooper. He is the director of Neighbor Impact, which is the community action agency in Central Oregon. Unfortunately, he became ill last night and was not able to make it. For those of you who know Scott, he is an intelligent, capable director and service provider, and I am none of those things, so I will be very brief today. Quickly, I want to say a little bit about community action. There is a statewide network of community action agencies. There's 18 of them around the state. They cover every county, and they either provide direct service or they partner with other nonprofits and pass resources through to other nonprofits that are doing work. They work a lot on housing and homeless issues. They work on emergency rent assistance, weatherization, a lot of these things that can be very helpful to families that are in a crisis situation. There's an example of a story that was sent to me that I had lots to choose from, but I wanted to share one quickly from this here in the Salem area. A case where there was a woman who had fled a domestic violence situation from another state, had come to Salem for safety, had brought her son, had a daughter with some mental health issues that she was separated from. At the time that she arrived at Community Action, she was living in a barn with no plumbing or heating with her son and was in a very desperate situation. Fortunately, there were resources available at that time within the Community Action Agency, so they were able to get her and her son immediately into some transitional housing and began working with her on a lot of the issues that result from the traumatic situation that she and her family had been in. About 8 months later, she was able to be reunited with her daughter, who continued to recover from these mental health issues. The entire family got into intensive counseling, and after 24 months, which is the limit of amount of time that they're allowed to use these particular resources to help with a case of homelessness, that family was stable enough that they were able to maintain their housing after that time. It's a tremendous example of how a lot of hard work, the right resources at the right time can all come together to really make a difference for kids, for families, for parents who want to provide for their kids. Scott Cooper had sent me some numbers from Central Oregon that I wanted to just reflect on very briefly. And Janet talked about the emergency housing account. The allocation of the emergency housing account that's received in Central Oregon is about $344,000, not an enormous amount of money. And that's for the entire Central Oregon region. They use that for direct rent assistance, for deposits, and all of the things that can sometimes be associated with getting into a place to live, and they also use it for case management. Last year, they were able to serve 118 households with this allocation. They turned away 5,723 households. So for every one household that they're able to help, there are 49 households that they're not able to help. Now, these are a combination of families that are either already experiencing homelessness or those that have an eviction notice in their hand and are on the verge of experiencing homelessness. We know that it's much more expensive to help a family once they've become homeless than before they become homeless, and yet when the numbers are like that, we have to go into triage mode. If there's a kid who's living without a roof that's a real problem. We've got to address that right away. We can get ahead of this, but right now we are not resourcing this the solutions that we have to be able to get them out to help enough people. I submitted for you to look at a release from the Department of Education, and it is also will be an OLIS. I encourage you to read it, but I really want to point out this chart at the bottom of the first page.
Yeah.
And this shows how direct the impact of homelessness is on the other objectives that we are, as a state, so committed to meeting. Education. Look at the impact of math, reading, and science scores on kids when you compare them. All of the students compared to kids that are listed as economically disadvantaged versus those that are experiencing homelessness or have experienced homelessness. It's remarkable, and it's not surprising. I mean, it's called homework. How do you do homework without a home? How do you do it in the back of a car? How do you, as a parent, hang up an A report card when you don't have a refrigerator to hang it on? It's so important that we think about how the ripple effects from homelessness spread to all these other goals that we have as a state. So I guess what I want to leave you with today is that this is a real problem that we know how to solve. We can do this. We have example after example of how we've been able to turn something around, and if we are if we have the right resources at the right time, we can make a real difference. I'm going to share a personal experience that happened to me just yesterday at dinner. I have a four-year-old daughter. She's very curious. She's very smart. I think she's very smart. She takes after her mother. She was driving around in her car seat with my wife, and they came to a stop sign, and there was a man standing there by the side of the road and saying, "Hey," you know, he had a sign, and my daughter's asking questions. What does the sign say? What does he want? And my wife is explaining to him that he doesn't have a home, and she says, "Well, why doesn't he have a home?" And she tries to sort of explain it, and she knows a little bit about what I do, and she says, "Well, maybe Daddy can help him." And she said that to me. My wife relayed this story to me at dinner last night, and, you know, it hit me here, but I thought about it, and I thought, no, I cannot help him, but we can help him. And when I say we can help him, I'm talking to you, I'm talking to everybody in this room. We can help him. We can help these kids. One out of three people counted in the last homeless count is a kid. Homelessness is not just that guy on the side of the road. It's kids in cars with their families, and we can help them. So that's what I want to inspire you to do in this short session. In the following session, we can do this.
Great job, Ryan. Thank you. Any quick questions or comments? We have about 1 minute. No, 2-3 minutes. Representative Gallegos, go for it.
Yeah, I just want to thank you all. I appreciate your comments, and especially June, your story. It's a great segue. Just at 11:30, there's a housing forum meeting, actually, housing opportunity lunch in room 243, which is just off the Senate room. So if you have some time, it'd be great to stop there, the committee or folks out there. But yes, thank you so much. Oregon Opportunity Network and some live folks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Anything more? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that was it.
Okay. Okay, I'm just going to make a couple of comments. As we were hearing about the mentally ill and the needs there, I mean, it's tragic. We need to do something about all this, certainly children. But can you imagine somebody who's mentally ill and
thank
being
you.
Homeless? How do you get services? How can you take care of yourself? How can you get medication or wraparound services? The other point that I wrote down, $334,000 that were given to all of Central Oregon for housing needs. That's what it costs one person in the state hospital for a year. Put it in perspective. Okay, any last words? Thank you. You are a wonderful committee. Wonderful committee.
Thank you.
Appreciate all the hard work you do. Look for you in February 3rd. Thank you so much. And thanks for everybody who came. With that, we close the Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thanks again. Thanks again. Committee on Human Services and Housing.